As we have seen, blacks had been politically disenfranchised in the 1890s with the use of poll taxes and literacy tests. These tests were routinely manipulated to discriminate against black people, while still allowing poor and illiterate whites to vote. In a famous example from the early 1960s, in Louisiana, a white applicant was judged literate after giving the answer, freedom, F-R-D-U-M, of, F-O-O-F, speech, S-P-E-T-G-H, to a question about the state constitution. The Supreme Court decision in 1944 was the opening salvo in the longer battle to open up the political system to blacks, and the court understood the importance of loosening white control of political parties. That decision was followed by Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, in which the Supreme Court ruled that state-mandated segregation of schools and other public sites was unconstitutional. In 1962, the court knocked away another pillar of the political dominance of white elites, legislative malapportionment. When a legislature is malapportioned, as were the rotten boroughs in England before the First Reform Act, some areas or regions receive much greater representation than they should based on their share of the relevant population. Malapportionment in the South meant that the rural areas, the heartland of the Southern planter elite, were heavily overrepresented relative to urban areas. The Supreme Court put an end to this in 1962 with its decision in the Baker v. Carr case, which introduced the one-person, one-vote standard. But all the rulings from the Supreme Court would have amounted to little if they hadn't been implemented. In the 1890s, in fact, federal legislation enfranchising Southern blacks was not implemented because local law enforcement was under the control of the Southern elite and the Democratic Party, and the federal government was happy to go along with this state of affairs. But as blacks started rising up against the Southern elite, this bastion of support for Jim Crow crumbled, and the Democratic Party, led by its non-Southern elements, turned against racial segregation. The renegade Southern Democrats regrouped under the banner of the States' Rights Democratic Party and competed in the 1948 presidential election. Their candidate, Strom Thurmond, carried four states and gained 39 votes in the Electoral College. But this was a far cry from the power of the Unified Democratic Party in national politics and the capture of that party by the Southern elites. Strom Thurmond's campaign was centered on his challenge to the ability of the federal government to intervene in the institutions of the South. He stated his position forcefully. "I want to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that there's not enough troops in the Army to force the Southern people to break down segregation and admit the Negro race into our theaters, into our swimming pools, into our homes, and into our churches." He would be proved wrong. The rulings of the Supreme Court meant that Southern educational facilities had to be desegregated, including the University of Mississippi in Oxford. In 1962, after a long legal battle, federal courts ruled that James Meredith, a young black Air Force veteran, had to be admitted to Ole Miss. Opposition to the implementation of this ruling was orchestrated by the so-called Citizens' Councils, the first of which had been formed in Indianola, Mississippi, in 1954 to fight desegregation of the South. State Governor Ross Barnett publicly rejected the court-ordered desegregation on television on September 13th, announcing that state universities would close before they agreed to be desegregated. Finally, after much negotiation between Barnett and President John Kennedy and Attorney General Robert Kennedy in Washington, the federal government intervened forcibly to implement this ruling. A day was set when U.S. Marshals would bring Meredith to Oxford. In anticipation, white supremacists began to organize. On September 30th, the day before Meredith was due to appear, U.S. Marshals entered the university campus and surrounded the main administration building. A crowd of about 2,500 came to protest, and soon a riot broke out. The marshals used tear gas to disperse the rioters, but soon came under fire. By 10 p.m. that night, federal troops were moved into the city to restore order. Soon there were 20,000 troops and 11,000 National Guardsmen in Oxford. In total, 300 people would be arrested. Meredith decided to stay on campus, where, protected from death threats by U.S. Marshals and 300 soldiers, he eventually graduated. Federal legislation was pivotal in the process of institutional reform in the South. During the passage of the first Civil Rights Act in 1957, Strom Thurmond, then a senator, spoke nonstop for 24 hours and 18 minutes to prevent or at least delay passage of the act. During his speech, he read everything from the Declaration of Independence to various phone books, but to no avail. The 1957 act culminated in the Civil Rights Act of 1964, outlawing a whole gamut of segregationist state legislation and practices. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 declared the literacy tests, poll taxes, and other methods used for disenfranchising Southern blacks to be illegal. It also extended a great deal of federal oversight into state elections. The impact of all these events was a significant change in economic and legal institutions in the South. In Mississippi, for example, only about 5% of eligible black people were voting in 1960. By 1970, this figure had increased to 50%. In Alabama and South Carolina, it went from around 10% in 1960 to 50% in 1970. These patterns changed the nature of elections, both for local and national offices. More important, the political support from the dominant Democratic Party for the extractive institutions discriminating against blacks eroded. The way was then open for a range of changes in economic institutions. Prior to the institutional reforms of the 1960s, blacks had been almost entirely excluded from jobs in textile mills. In 1960, only about 5% of employees in Southern textile mills were black. Civil rights legislation stopped this discrimination. By 1970, this proportion had increased to 15%. By 1990, it was at 25%. Economic discrimination against blacks began to decline. The educational opportunities for blacks improved significantly, and the Southern labor market became more competitive. Together with inclusive institutions came more rapid economic improvements in the South. In 1940, Southern states had only about 50% of the level of per capita income of the United States. This started to change in the late 1940s and 50s. By 1990, the gap had basically vanished. As in Botswana, the key in the U.S. South was the development of inclusive political and economic institutions. This came at the juxtaposition of the increasing discontent among blacks suffering under Southern extractive institutions and the crumbling of the one-party rule of the Democratic Party in the South. Once again, existing institutions shaped the path of change. In this case, it was pivotal that Southern institutions were situated within the inclusive federal institutions of the United States, and this allowed Southern blacks finally to mobilize the federal government and institutions for their cause. The whole process was also facilitated by the fact that, with the massive out-migration of blacks from the South and the mechanization of cotton production, economic conditions had changed so that Southern elites were less willing to put up more of a fight. Rebirth in China. The Communist Party, under the leadership of Mao Zedong, finally overthrew the Nationalists, led by Chiang Kai-shek, in 1949. The People's Republic of China was proclaimed on October 1st. The political and economic institutions created after 1949 were highly extractive. Politically, they featured the dictatorship of the Chinese Communist Party. No other political organization has been allowed in China since then. Until his death in 1976, Mao entirely dominated the Communist Party and the government. Accompanying these authoritarian, extractive political institutions were highly extractive economic institutions. Mao immediately nationalized land and abolished all kinds of property rights in one fell swoop. He had landlords, as well as other segments he deemed to be against the regime, executed. The market economy was essentially abolished. People in rural areas were gradually organized onto communal farms. Money and wages were replaced by work points, which could be traded for goods. Internal passports were introduced in 1956, forbidding travel without appropriate authorization in order to increase political and economic control. All industry was similarly nationalized, and Mao launched an ambitious attempt to promote the rapid development of industry through the use of 5-year plans modeled on those in the Soviet Union. As with all extractive institutions, Mao's regime was attempting to extract resources from the vast country he was now controlling. As in the case of the government of Sierra Leone with its marketing board, the Chinese Communist Party had a monopoly over the sale of produce, such as rice and grain, which was used to heavily tax farmers. The attempts at industrialization turned into the infamous Great Leap Forward after 1958 with the rollout of the second 5-year plan. Mao announced that steel output would double in a year based on small-scale backyard blast furnaces. He claimed that in 15 years, China would catch up with British steel production. The only problem was that there was no feasible way of meeting these targets. To meet the plan's goals, scrap metal had to be found, and people would have to melt down their pots and pans and even their agricultural implements such as hoes and plows. Workers who ought to have been tending the fields were making steel by destroying their plows, and thus their future ability to feed themselves and the country. The result was a calamitous famine in the Chinese countryside. Though scholars debate the role of Mao's policy compared with the impact of droughts at the same time, nobody doubts the central role of the Great Leap Forward in contributing to the death of between 20 and 40 million people. We don't know precisely how many, because China, under Mao, did not collect the numbers that would have documented the atrocities. Per capita income fell by around one quarter. One consequence of the Great Leap Forward was that a senior member of the Communist Party, Deng Xiaoping, a very successful general during the revolution, who led an anti-rightist campaign resulting in the execution of many enemies of the revolution, had a change of heart. At a conference in Guangzhou, in the south of China in 1961, Deng argued, "No matter whether the cat is black or white, if it catches mice, it's a good cat." It did not matter whether policies appeared communist or not. China needed policies that would encourage production so that it could feed its people. Yet Deng was soon to suffer for his newfound practicality. On May 16, 1966, Mao announced that the revolution was under threat from bourgeois interests that were undermining China's communist society and wishing to recreate capitalism. In response, he announced the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, usually referred to as the Cultural Revolution. The Cultural Revolution was based on 16 points. The first started, "Although the bourgeoisie has been overthrown, it is still trying to use the old ideas, culture, and customs and habits of the exploiting classes to corrupt the masses, capture their minds, and endeavor to stage a comeback. The proletariat must do just the opposite. It must meet head-on every challenge of the bourgeoisie in the ideological field and use the new ideas, culture, customs, and habits of the proletariat to change the mental outlook of the whole of society. At present, our objective is to struggle against and crush those persons in authority who are taking the capitalist road, to criticize and repudiate the reactionary bourgeois academic authorities and the ideology of the bourgeoisie and all other exploiting classes, and transform education, literature, and art, and all other parts of the superstructure that do not correspond to the socialist economic base, so as to facilitate the consolidation and development of the socialist system." Soon, the Cultural Revolution, just like the Great Leap Forward, would start wrecking both the economy and many human lives. Units of Red Guards were formed across the country. Young, enthusiastic members of the Communist Party, who were used to purge opponents of the regime. Many people were killed, arrested, or sent into internal exile. Mao himself retorted to concerns about the extent of the violence, stating, "This man Hitler was even more ferocious. The more ferocious, the better, don't you think? The more people you kill, the more revolutionary you are." Deng found himself labeled number 2 capitalist roader, was jailed in 1967, and then was exiled to Jiangxi province in 1969 to work in a rural tractor factory. He was rehabilitated in 1974, and Mao was persuaded by Premier Zhou Enlai to make Deng first vice premier. Already in 1975, Deng supervised the composition of 3 party documents that would have charted a new direction had they been adopted. They called for a revitalization of higher education, a return to material incentives in industry and agriculture, and the removal of leftists from the party. At the time, Mao's health was deteriorating, and power was increasingly concentrated in the hands of the very leftists whom Deng Xiaoping wanted to remove from power. Mao's wife, Chiang Qing, and three of her close associates, collectively known as the Gang of Four, had been great supporters of the Cultural Revolution and the resulting repression. They intended to continue using this blueprint to run the country under the dictatorship of the Communist Party. On April 5th, a spontaneous celebration of the life of Zhou Enlai in Tiananmen Square turned into a protest against the government. The Gang of Four blamed Deng for the demonstrations, and he was once more stripped of all his positions and dismissed. Instead of achieving the removal of the leftists, Deng found that the leftists had removed him. After the death of Zhou Enlai, Mao had appointed Hua Guofeng as the acting premier instead of Deng. In the relative power vacuum of 1976, Hua was able to accumulate a great deal of personal power. In September, there was a critical juncture. Mao died. The Chinese Communist Party had been under Mao's domination, and the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution had been largely his initiatives. With Mao gone, there was a true power vacuum, which resulted in a struggle between those with different visions and different beliefs about the consequences of change. The Gang of Four intended to continue with the policies of the Cultural Revolution as the only way of consolidating theirs and the Communist Party's power. Hua Guofeng wanted to abandon the Cultural Revolution, but he could not distance himself too much from it because he owed his own rise in the party to its effects. Instead, he advocated a return to a more balanced version of Mao's vision, which he encapsulated in the two whatevers, as the People's Daily, the newspaper of the Chinese Communist Party, put it in 1977. Hua argued, "We will resolutely uphold whatever policy decisions Chairman Mao made, and unswervingly follow whatever instructions Chairman Mao gave." Deng Xiaoping did not wish to abolish the communist regime and replace it with inclusive markets any more than Hua did. He, too, was part of the same group of people brought to power by the Communist Revolution. But he and his supporters thought that significant economic growth could be achieved without endangering their political control. They had a model of growth under extractive political institutions that would not threaten their power, because the Chinese people were in dire need of improved living standards, and because all meaningful opposition to the Communist Party had been obliterated during Mao's reign and the Cultural Revolution. To achieve this, they wished to repudiate not just the Cultural Revolution, but also much of the Maoist institutional legacy. They realized that economic growth would be possible only with significant moves toward inclusive economic institutions. They thus wished to reform the economy and bolster the role of market forces and incentives. They also wanted to expand the scope for private ownership and reduce the role of the Communist Party in society and the administration, getting rid of such concepts as class struggle. Deng's group was also open to foreign investment and international trade, and wished to pursue a much more aggressive policy of integrating with the international economy. Still, there were limits, and building truly inclusive economic institutions and significantly lessening the grip the Communist Party had on the economy weren't even options. The turning point for China was Hua Guofeng's power and his willingness to use it against the Gang of Four. Within a month of Mao's death, Hua mounted a coup against the Gang of Four, having them all arrested. He then reinstated Deng in March 1977. There was nothing inevitable either about this course of events or about the next significant steps, which resulted from Hua himself being politically outmaneuvered by Deng Xiaoping. Deng encouraged public criticism of the Cultural Revolution and began to fill key positions in the Communist Party at all levels with people who, like him, had suffered during this period. Hua could not repudiate the Cultural Revolution, and this weakened him. He was also a comparative newcomer to the centers of power, and he lacked the web of connections and informal relations that Deng had built up over many years. In a series of speeches, Deng began to criticize Hua's policies. In September 1978, he explicitly attacked the two whatevers, noting that rather than let whatever Mao had said determine policy, the correct approach was to seek truth from facts. Deng also brilliantly began to bring public pressure to bear on Hua, which was reflected most powerfully in the Democracy Wall movement in 1978, in which people posted complaints about the country on a wall in Beijing. In July of 1978, one of Deng's supporters, Hu Qiaomu, presented some basic principles of economic reform. These included the notions that firms should be given greater initiative and authority to make their own production decisions. Prices should be allowed to bring supply and demand together, rather than just being set by the government, and the state regulation of the economy more generally ought to be reduced. These were radical suggestions, but Deng was gaining influence. In November and December 1978, the third plenum of the 11th Central Party Committee produced a breakthrough. Over Hua's objections, it was decided that from then on, the focus of the party would be not class struggle, but economic modernization. The plenum announced some tentative experiments with a household responsibility system in some provinces, which was an attempt to roll back collective agriculture and introduce economic incentives into farming. By the next year, the Central Committee was acknowledging the centrality of the notion of truth from facts and declaring the Cultural Revolution to have been a great calamity for the Chinese people. Throughout this period, Deng was securing the appointment of his own supporters to important positions in the party, army, and government. Though he had to move slowly against Hua's supporters in the Central Committee, he created parallel bases of power. By 1980, Hua was forced to step down from the premiership to be replaced by Cao Zuiyang. By 1982, Hua had been removed from the Central Committee. But Deng did not stop there. At the 12th Party Congress in 1982, and then in the National Party Conference in September 1985, he achieved an almost complete reshuffling of the party leadership and senior cadres. In came much younger, reform-minded people. If one compares 1980 to 1985, then by the latter date, 21 of the 26 members of the Politburo, 8 of the 11 members of the Communist Party Secretariat, and 10 of the 18 vice premiers had been changed. Now that Deng and the reformers had consummated their political revolution and were in control of the state, they launched a series of further changes in economic institutions. They began in agriculture. By 1983, following the ideas of Hu Qiaomu, the household responsibility system, which would provide economic incentives to farmers, was universally adopted. In 1985, the mandatory state purchasing of grain was abandoned and replaced by a system of more voluntary contracts. Administrative control of agricultural prices was greatly relaxed in 1985. In the urban economy, state enterprises were given more autonomy, and 14 open cities were identified and given the ability to attract foreign investment. It was the rural economy that took off first. The introduction of incentives led to a dramatic increase in agricultural productivity. By 1984, grain output was one-third higher than in 1978, though fewer people were involved in agriculture. Many had moved into employment in new rural industries, the so-called township-village enterprises. These had been allowed to grow outside the system of state industrial planning after 1979, when it was accepted that new firms could enter and compete with state-owned firms. Gradually, economic incentives were also introduced into the industrial sector, in particular into the operation of state-run enterprises, though at this stage there was no hint at privatization, which had to wait until the mid-1990s. The rebirth of China came with a significant move away from one of the most extractive set of economic institutions and toward more inclusive ones. Market incentives in agriculture and industry, then followed by foreign investment and technology, would set China on a path to rapid economic growth. As we will discuss further in the next chapter, this was growth under extractive political institutions, even if they were not as repressive as they had been under the Cultural Revolution, and even if economic institutions were becoming partially inclusive. All of this should not understate the degree to which the changes in economic institutions in China were radical. China broke the mold, even if it did not transform its political institutions. As in Botswana and the U.S. South, the crucial changes came during a critical juncture, in the case of China, following Mao's death. They were also contingent, in fact, highly contingent, as there was nothing inevitable about the Gang of Four losing the power struggle. And if they had not, China would not have experienced the sustained economic growth it has seen in the last 30 years. But the devastation and human suffering that the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution caused generated sufficient demand for change that Deng Xiaoping and his allies were able to win the political fight. Botswana, China, and the U.S. South, just like the Glorious Revolution in England, the French Revolution, and the Meiji Restoration in Japan, are vivid illustrations that history is not destiny. Despite the vicious circle, extractive institutions can be replaced by inclusive ones. But it is neither automatic nor easy. A confluence of factors, in particular a critical juncture coupled with a broad coalition of those pushing for reform or other propitious existing institutions, is often necessary for a nation to make strides toward more inclusive institutions. In addition, some luck is key, because history always unfolds in a contingent way. Chapter 15. Understanding Prosperity and Poverty. Historical Origins. There are huge differences in living standards around the world. Even the poorest citizens of the United States have incomes and access to health care, education, public services, and economic and social opportunities that are far superior to those available to the vast mass of people living in sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, and Central America. The contrast of South and North Korea, the two Nogaleses, and the United States and Mexico reminds us that these are relatively recent phenomena. 500 years ago, Mexico, home to the Aztec state, was certainly richer than the polities to the north, and the United States did not pull ahead of Mexico until the 19th century. The gap between the two Nogaleses is even more recent. South and North Korea were economically, as well as socially and culturally, indistinguishable before the country was divided at the 38th parallel after the Second World War. Similarly, most of the huge economic differences we observe around us today emerged over the last 200 years, and mostly over the last 200 years. Did this all need to be so? Was it historically or geographically or culturally or ethnically predetermined that Western Europe, the United States, and Japan would become so much richer than sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and China over the last 200 years or so? Was it inevitable that the Industrial Revolution would get underway in the 18th century in Britain and then spread to Western Europe and Europe's offshoots in North America and Australasia? Is a counterfactual world where the Glorious Revolution and the Industrial Revolution take place in Peru, which then colonizes Western Europe and enslaves whites, possible? Or is it just a form of historical science fiction? To answer, in fact, even to reason about these questions, we need a theory of why some nations are prosperous while others fail and are poor. This theory needs to delineate both the factors that create and retard prosperity and their historical origins. This book has proposed such a theory. Any complex social phenomenon, such as the origins of the different economic and political trajectories of hundreds of polities around the world, likely has a multitude of causes, making most social scientists shun monocausal, simple, and broadly applicable theories, and instead seek different explanations for seemingly similar outcomes emerging in different times and areas. Instead, we've offered a simple theory and used it to explain the main contours of economic and political development around the world since the Neolithic Revolution. Our choice was motivated not by a naive belief that such a theory could explain everything, but by the belief that a theory should enable us to focus on the parallels, sometimes at the expense of abstracting from many interesting details. A successful theory, then, does not faithfully reproduce details, but provides a useful and empirically well-grounded explanation for a range of processes, while also clarifying the main forces at work. Our theory has attempted to achieve this by operating on two levels. The first is the distinction between extractive and inclusive economic and political institutions. The second is our explanation for why inclusive institutions emerged in some parts of the world and not in others. While the first level of our theory is about an institutional interpretation of history, the second level is about how history has shaped institutional trajectories of nations. Central to our theory is the link between inclusive economic and political institutions and prosperity. Inclusive economic institutions that enforce property rights, create a level playing field, and encourage investments in new technologies and skills are more conducive to economic growth than extractive economic institutions that are structured to extract resources from the many by the few, and that fail to protect property rights or provide incentives for economic activity. Inclusive economic institutions are in turn supported by and support inclusive political institutions, that is, those that distribute political power widely in a pluralistic manner and are able to achieve some amount of political centralization so as to establish law and order, the foundations of secure property rights, and an inclusive market economy. Similarly, extractive economic institutions are synergistically linked to extractive political institutions, which concentrate power in the hands of a few, who will then have incentives to maintain and develop extractive economic institutions for their benefit, and use the resources they obtain to cement their hold on political power. These tendencies do not imply that extractive economic and political institutions are inconsistent with economic growth. On the contrary, every elite would, all else being equal, like to encourage as much growth as possible in order to have more to extract. Extractive institutions that have achieved at least a minimal degree of political centralization are often able to generate some amount of growth. What is crucial, however, is that growth under extractive institutions will not be sustained for two key reasons. First, sustained economic growth requires innovation, and innovation cannot be decoupled from creative destruction, which replaces the old with the new in the economic realm and also destabilizes established power relations in politics. Because elites dominating extractive institutions fear creative destruction, they will resist it, and any growth that germinates under extractive institutions will be ultimately short-lived. Second, the ability of those who dominate extractive institutions to benefit greatly at the expense of the rest of society implies that political power under extractive institutions is highly coveted, making many groups and individuals fight to obtain it. As a consequence, there will be powerful forces pushing societies under extractive institutions toward political instability. The synergies between extractive economic and political institutions create a vicious circle, where extractive institutions, once in place, tend to persist. Similarly, there is a virtuous circle associated with inclusive economic and political institutions, but neither the vicious nor the virtuous circle is absolute. In fact, some nations live under inclusive institutions today because, though extractive institutions have been the norm in history, some societies have been able to break the mold and transition toward inclusive institutions. Our explanation for these transitions is historical, but not historically predetermined. Major institutional change, the requisite for major economic change, takes place as a result of the interaction between existing institutions and critical junctures. Critical junctures are major events that disrupt the existing political and economic balance in one or many societies, such as the Black Death, which killed possibly as much as half the population of most areas in Europe during the 14th century, the opening of Atlantic trade routes, which created enormous profit opportunities for many in Western Europe, and the Industrial Revolution, which offered the potential for rapid but also disruptive changes in the structure of economies around the world. Existing institutional differences among societies themselves are a result of past institutional changes. Why does the path of institutional change differ across societies? The answer to this question lies in institutional drift. In the same way that the genes of two isolated populations of organisms will drift apart slowly because of random mutations in the so-called process of evolutionary or genetic drift, two otherwise similar societies will also drift apart institutionally, albeit again slowly. Conflict over income and power, and indirectly over institutions, is a constant in all societies. This conflict often has a contingent outcome, even if the playing field over which it transpires is not level. The outcome of this conflict leads to institutional drift, but this is not necessarily a cumulative process. It does not imply that the small differences that emerge at some point will necessarily become larger over time. On the contrary, as our discussion of Roman Britain in Chapter 6 illustrates, small differences open up and then disappear and then reappear again. However, when a critical juncture arrives, these small differences that have emerged as a result of institutional drift may be the small differences that matter in leading otherwise quite similar societies to diverge radically. We saw in chapters 7 and 8 that despite the many similarities between England, France, and Spain, the critical juncture of the Atlantic trade had the most transformative impact on England because of such small differences. The fact that because of developments during the 15th and 16th centuries, the English crown could not control all overseas trade, as this trade was mostly under crown monopoly in France and Spain. As a result, in France and Spain, it was the monarchy and the groups allied with it who were the main beneficiaries of the large profits created by Atlantic trade and colonial expansion, while in England, it was groups strongly opposed to the monarchy who gained from economic opportunities thrown open by this critical juncture. Though institutional drift leads to small differences, its interplay with critical junctures leads to institutional divergence, and thus this divergence then creates the now more major institutional differences that the next critical juncture will affect. History is key, since it is historical processes that, via institutional drift, create the differences that may become consequential during critical junctures. Critical junctures themselves are historical turning points, and the vicious and virtuous circles imply that we have to study history to understand the nature of institutional differences that have been historically structured. Yet our theory does not imply historical determinism or any other kind of determinism. It is for this reason that the answer to the question we started with in this chapter is no. There was no historical necessity that Peru end up so much poorer than Western Europe or the United States. To start with, in contrast with the geography and culture hypotheses, Peru is not condemned to poverty because of its geography or culture. In our theory, Peru is so much poorer than Western Europe and the United States today because of its institutions, and to understand the reasons for this, we need to understand the historical process of institutional development in Peru. As we saw in the second chapter, 500 years ago, the Inca Empire, which occupied contemporary Peru, was richer, more technologically sophisticated, and more politically centralized than the smaller polities occupying North America. The turning point was the way in which this area was colonized, and how this contrasted with the colonization of North America. This resulted not from a historically predetermined process, but as the contingent outcome of several pivotal institutional developments during critical junctures. At least three factors could have changed this trajectory and led to very different long-run patterns. First, institutional differences within the Americas during the 15th century shaped how these areas were colonized. North America followed a different institutional trajectory than Peru, because it was sparsely settled before colonization and attracted European settlers who then successfully rose up against the elite whom entities such as the Virginia Company and the English Crown had tried to create. In contrast, Spanish conquistadors found a centralized, extractive state in Peru they could take over and a large population they could put to work in mines and plantations. There was also nothing geographically predetermined about the lay of the land within the Americas at the time the Europeans arrived, in the same way that the emergence of a centralized state led by King Shyam among the Bushong was a result of a major institutional innovation, or perhaps even of political revolution, as we saw in Chapter 5. The Inca civilization in Peru and the large populations in this area resulted from major institutional innovations. These could instead have taken place in North America, in places such as the Mississippi Valley, or even the northeastern United States. Had this been the case, Europeans might have encountered empty lands in the Andes and centralized states in North America, and the roles of Peru and the United States could have been reversed. Europeans would then have settled in areas around Peru, and the conflict between the majority of settlers and the elite could have led to the creation of inclusive institutions there instead of in North America. The subsequent paths of economic development would then likely have been different. Second, the Inca Empire might have resisted European colonialism, as Japan did when Commodore Perry's ships arrived in Edo Bay. Though the greater extractiveness of the Inca Empire, in contrast with Tokugawa Japan, certainly made a political revolution akin to the Meiji Restoration less likely in Peru, there was no historical necessity that the Inca completely succumb to European domination. If they had been able to resist and even institutionally modernize in response to the threats, the whole path of the history of the New World, and with it the entire history of the world, could have been different. Third, and most radically, it is not even historically or geographically or culturally predetermined that Europeans should have been the ones colonizing the world. It could have been the Chinese, or even the Incas. Of course, such an outcome is impossible when we look at the world from the vantage point of the 15th century, by which time Western Europe had pulled ahead of the Americas, and China had already turned inward. But Western Europe of the 15th century was itself an outcome of a contingent process of institutional drift, punctuated by critical junctures, and nothing about it was inevitable. Western European powers could not have surged ahead and conquered the world without several historic turning points. These included the specific path that feudalism took, replacing slavery and weakening the power of monarchs on the way. The fact that the centuries following the turn of the first millennium in Europe witnessed the development of independent and commercially autonomous cities. The fact that European monarchs were not as threatened by, and consequently did not try to discourage, overseas trade as the Chinese emperors did during the Ming Dynasty. And the arrival of the Black Death, which shook up the foundations of the feudal order. If these events had transpired differently, we could be living in a very different world today, one in which Peru might be richer than Western Europe or the United States. Naturally, the predictive power of a theory where both small differences and contingency play key roles will be limited. Few would have predicted in the 15th or even the 16th centuries, let alone in the many centuries following the fall of the Roman Empire, that the major breakthrough toward inclusive institutions would happen in Britain. It was only the specific process of institutional drift and the nature of the critical juncture created by the opening of Atlantic trade that made this possible. Neither would many have believed in the midst of the Cultural Revolution during the 1970s that China would soon be on a path toward radical changes in its economic institutions, and subsequently on a breakneck growth trajectory. It is similarly impossible to predict with any certainty what the lay of the land will be in 500 years. Yet these are not shortcomings of our theory. The historical account we have presented so far indicates that any approach based on historical determinism, based on geography, culture, or even other historical factors, is inadequate. Small differences and contingency are not just part of our theory. They are part of the shape of history. Even if making precise predictions about which societies will prosper relative to others is difficult, we have seen throughout the book that our theory explains the broad differences in the prosperity and poverty of nations around the world fairly well. We will see in the rest of this chapter that it also provides some guidelines as to what types of societies are more likely to achieve economic growth over the next several decades. First, vicious and virtuous circles generate a lot of persistence and sluggishness. There should be little doubt that in 50 or even 100 years, the United States and Western Europe, based on their inclusive economic and political institutions, will be richer, most likely considerably richer, than sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, Central America, or Southeast Asia. However, within these broad patterns, there will be major institutional changes in the next century, with some countries breaking the mold and transitioning from poor to rich. Nations that have achieved almost no political centralization, such as Somalia and Afghanistan, or those that have undergone a collapse of the state, such as Haiti did over the last several decades, long before the massive earthquake there in 2010 led to the devastation of the country's infrastructure, are unlikely either to achieve growth under the extractive political institutions or to make major changes toward inclusive institutions. Instead, nations likely to grow over the next several decades, albeit probably under extractive institutions, are those that have attained some degree of political centralization. In sub-Saharan Africa, this includes Burundi, Ethiopia, Rwanda, nations with long histories of centralized states, and Tanzania, which has managed to build such centralization, or at least put in place some of the prerequisites for centralization since independence. In Latin America, it includes Brazil, Chile, and Mexico, which have not only achieved political centralization, but also made significant strides toward nascent pluralism. Our theory would suggest that sustained economic growth is very unlikely in Colombia. Our theory also suggests that growth under extractive political institutions, as in China, will not bring sustained growth and is likely to run out of steam. Beyond these cases, there is much more uncertainty. Cuba, for example, might transition toward inclusive institutions and experience a major economic transformation, or it may linger on under extractive political and economic institutions. The same is true of North Korea and Burma, Myanmar, in Asia. Thus, while our theory provides the tools for thinking about how institutions change and the consequences of such changes, the nature of this change, the role of small differences and contingency, makes more precise predictions difficult. Even greater caution is necessary in drawing policy recommendations from this broad account of the origins of prosperity and poverty. In the same way that the impact of critical junctures depends on existing institutions, how a society will respond to the same policy intervention depends on the institutions that are in place. Of course, our theory is all about how nations can take steps toward prosperity by transforming their institutions from extractive to inclusive. But it also makes it very clear from the outset that there are no easy recipes for achieving such a transition. First, the vicious circle implies that changing institutions is much harder than it first appears. In particular, extractive institutions can recreate themselves under different guises, as we saw with the Iron Law of Oligarchy in Chapter 12. Thus, the fact that the extractive regime of President Mubarak was overturned by popular protest in February 2011 does not guarantee that Egypt will move onto a path to more inclusive institutions. Instead, extractive institutions may recreate themselves, despite the vibrant and hopeful pro-democracy movement. Second, because the contingent path of history implies that it is difficult to know whether a particular interplay of critical junctures and existing institutional differences will lead toward more inclusive or extractive institutions. It would be heroic to formulate general policy recommendations to encourage change toward inclusive institutions. Nevertheless, our theory is still useful for policy analysis, as it enables us to recognize bad policy advice, based on either incorrect hypotheses or inadequate understanding of how institutions can change. In this, as in most things, avoiding the worst mistakes is as important as, and more realistic than, attempting to develop simple solutions. Perhaps this is most clearly visible when we consider current policy recommendations encouraging authoritarian growth, based on the successful Chinese growth experience of the last several decades. We next explain why these policy recommendations are misleading and why Chinese growth, as it has unfolded so far, is just another form of growth under extractive political institutions, unlikely to translate into sustained economic development. The irresistible charm of authoritarian growth. Dai Guofeng recognized the coming urban boom in China early on. New highways, business centers, residences, and skyscrapers were sprawling everywhere around China in the 1990s, and Dai thought this growth would only pick up speed in the next decade. He reasoned that his company, Changsu, Xiamen, Iron and Steel, could capture a large market as a low-cost producer, especially compared with the inefficient state-owned steel factories. Dai planned to build a true steel giant, and with support from the local party bosses in Changzhou, he started building in 2003. By March 2004, however, the project had been stopped by order of the Chinese Communist Party in Beijing, and Dai was arrested for reasons never clearly articulated. The authorities may have presumed that they would find some incriminating evidence in Dai's accounts. In the event, he spent the next 5 years in jail and home detention, and was found guilty on a minor charge in 2009. His real crime was to start a large project that would compete with state-sponsored companies, and do so without the approval of the higher-ups in the Communist Party. This was certainly the lesson that others drew from the case. The Communist Party's reaction to entrepreneurs such as Dai should not be a surprise. Chen Yun, one of Deng Xiaoping's closest associates, and arguably the major architect behind the early market reforms, summarized the views of most party cadres with a bird-in-the-cage analogy for the economy. China's economy was the bird. The party's control, the cage, had to be enlarged to make the bird healthier and more dynamic, but it could not be unlocked or removed, lest the bird fly away. Jiang Zemin, shortly after becoming General Secretary of the Communist Party in 1989, the most powerful position in China, went even further and summarized the party's suspicion of entrepreneurs by characterizing them as self-employed traders and peddlers who cheat, embezzle, bribe, and evade taxation. Throughout the 1990s, even as foreign investment was pouring into China and state-owned enterprises were encouraged to expand, private entrepreneurship was greeted with suspicion, and many entrepreneurs were expropriated or even jailed. Jiang Zemin's view of entrepreneurs, though in relative decline, is still widespread in China. In the words of a Chinese economist, big state companies can get involved in huge projects, but when private companies do so, especially in competition with the state, then trouble comes from every corners. While scores of private companies are now profitably operating in China, many elements of the economy are still under the party's command and protection. Journalist Richard McGregor reports that on the desk of the head of each of the biggest state companies in China stands a red phone. When it rings, it is the party calling with orders on what the company should do, where it should invest, and what its targets will be. These giant companies are still under the command of the party, a fact that we are reminded of when the party decides to shuffle their chief executives, fire them, or promote them with little explanation. These stories, of course, do not deny that China has made great strides toward inclusive economic institutions, strides that underpin its spectacular growth rates over the past 30 years. Most entrepreneurs have some security, not least because they cultivate the support of local cadres and Communist Party elites in Beijing. Most state-owned enterprises seek profits and compete in international markets. This is a radical change from the China of Mao. As we saw in the previous chapter, China was first able to grow because under Deng Xiaoping, there were radical reforms away from the most extractive economic institutions and toward inclusive economic institutions. Growth has continued as Chinese economic institutions have been on a path toward greater inclusiveness, albeit at a slower pace. China is also greatly benefiting from its large supply of cheap labor and its access to foreign markets, capital, and technologies. Even if Chinese economic institutions are incomparably more inclusive today than 3 decades ago, the Chinese experience is an example of growth under extractive political institutions. Despite the recent emphasis in China on innovation and technology, Chinese growth is based on the adoption of existing technologies and rapid investment, not creative destruction. An important aspect of this is that property rights are not entirely secure in China. Every now and then, just like Dai, some entrepreneurs are expropriated. Labor mobility is tightly regulated, and the most basic of property rights, the right to sell one's own labor in the way one wishes, is still highly imperfect. The extent to which economic institutions are still far from being truly inclusive is illustrated by the fact that only a few businessmen and women would even venture into any activity without the support of the local party cadre, or, even more important, of Beijing. The connection between business and the party is highly lucrative for both. Businesses supported by the party receive contracts on favorable terms, can evict ordinary people to expropriate their land, and violate laws and regulations with impunity. Those who stand in the path of this business plan will be trampled and can even be jailed or murdered. The all-too-present weight of the Communist Party and extractive institutions in China remind us of the many similarities between Soviet growth in the 1950s and 60s and Chinese growth today, though there are also notable differences. The Soviet Union achieved growth under extractive economic institutions and extractive political institutions because it forcibly allocated resources toward industry under a centralized command structure, particularly armaments and heavy industry. Such growth was feasible, partly because there was a lot of catching up to be done. Growth under extractive institutions is easier when creative destruction is not a necessity. Chinese economic institutions are certainly more inclusive than those in the Soviet Union, but China's political institutions are still extractive. The Communist Party is all-powerful in China and controls the entire state bureaucracy, the armed forces, the media, and large parts of the economy. Chinese people have few political freedoms and very little participation in the political process. Many have long believed that growth in China would bring democracy and greater pluralism. There was a real sense in 1989 that the Tiananmen Square demonstrations would lead to greater opening and perhaps even the collapse of the communist regime. But tanks were unleashed on the demonstrators, and instead of a peaceful revolution, history books now call it the Tiananmen Square Massacre. In many ways, Chinese political institutions became more extractive in the aftermath of Tiananmen. Reformers such as Cao Ziyang, who as General Secretary of the Communist Party lent his support to the students in Tiananmen Square, were purged, and the party clamped down on civil liberties and press freedom with greater zeal. Cao Ziyang was put under house arrest for more than 15 years, and his public record was gradually erased, so that he would not be even a symbol for those who supported political change. Today, the party's control over the media, including the Internet, is unprecedented. Much of this is achieved through self-censorship. Media outlets know that they should not mention Cao Ziyang or Liu Xiaobo, the government critic demanding greater democratization, who is still languishing in prison, even as he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Self-censorship is supported by an Orwellian apparatus that can monitor conversations and communications, close websites and newspapers, and even selectively block access to individual news stories on the Internet. All of this was on display when news about corruption charges against the son of the General Secretary of the party since 2002, Hu Jintao, broke out in 2009. The party's apparatus immediately sprang into action and was not only able to prevent Chinese media from covering the case, but also managed to selectively block stories about the case on the New York Times and Financial Times websites. Because of the party's control over economic institutions, the extent of creative destruction is heavily curtailed, and it will remain so until there is radical reform in political institutions. Just as in the Soviet Union, the Chinese experience of growth under extractive political institutions is greatly facilitated, because there is a lot of catching up to do. Income per capita in China is still a fraction of that in the United States and Western Europe. Of course, Chinese growth is considerably more diversified than Soviet growth. It doesn't rely on only armaments or heavy industry. And Chinese entrepreneurs are showing a lot of ingenuity. All the same, this growth will run out of steam unless extractive political institutions make way for inclusive institutions. As long as political institutions remain extractive, growth will be inherently limited, as it has been in all other similar cases. The Chinese experience does raise several interesting questions about the future of Chinese growth, and more important, the desirability and viability of authoritarian growth. Such growth has become a popular alternative to the Washington consensus.